I'd like to speak tonight about the deconstruction of beliefs. Wisdom traditions and practices that wisdom traditions offer. They exist in this world for the essential purpose of releasing human beings from limitation, bondage, and the perception of separation, the perception of separateness that hovers at the base of the conditioned mind. As human beings, through time, are exposed to and engage in such traditions and practices, interpersonal, social, and various cultural activities take place. It's a natural outpouring of the sense that the perception of separateness is indeed not essentially what we are about, but rather interconnectedness, relatedness, intimacy, unicity, are what we're made of and what we're expressing as we live our lives, even as we may struggle to relate, to connect, to understand ourselves or others. These social, cultural, communal, interpersonal events, like this retreat, is an outpouring. It's a coming forth of what it is that we're essentially made of. And while these cultural, social, communal, religious events and group activities can be entertaining, stimulating, fulfilling, rewarding, they are not essentially why teachings of freedom and happiness are here and have been given. These events, activities are like surface structures that sit upon a primal root that nourishes and sustains the surface. Yet it's quite possible to overfocus and fixate upon the surface structure and lose sight of it, and even worse, perhaps, never access the primal root of nourishment. If we look at this, there's many reasons why this can happen. Fixation on the surface. Unconscious and sometimes conscious, psychological and emotional drives and needs, which we can collectively and individually be feeling and expressing, brings people together for exploration, for conversation, for interaction, for learning. But until human beings, and it seems to be one at a time, until human beings realize the primal root of nourishment, which, by the way, is also the ultimate medicine, until this is realized, that human being or human beings will be vulnerable to over-involvement in the surface structures. I want to ask you, how many more prayer meetings do we need, or discussion groups, before perhaps we realize that what we might be cultivating in such a prayer group or a discussion group is certain kinds of feelings and certain kind of shared beliefs You think like me, you feel like me, you talk like me, you're enough like me, let's hang out. Let's be together. Look at religious groups on the face of the earth. I'm not saying this is the only thing that brings those groups together. And by no means am I judging the groups. Let's call the spade the spade. And sometimes in these activities of so-called togetherness, the shared beliefs are there, the shared doctrine is there, the feelings of commonality, of community, of like-mindedness, whatever you call it. Through this, sometimes human beings are trying to strategize their way out of what ails them. Confusing this by pursuing pleasures. Nothing wrong with pleasure. And yet, even the experience of each other's company sometimes can be used as a distraction from what really ails us. And if you don't know what really ails you, then you're not going to know what the primal root of nourishment is. You're not going to have a sense, even though you might want it, you're not going to have a sense of what the ultimate medicine is. So it's very important, I would say, right now, or any right now, what do you want? What do you really want? Well, another way to get at that is why? Why are you here right now, as opposed to any other place that you might be tonight? Or this weekend? Or any moment that you isolate out, so to speak? Why are you there? When I speak about these social, communal, interpersonal comings together, in no way am I saying that intimate, honest, and direct contact between human beings in the space of honesty, truthfulness, courage, and inquiry is not a vehicle for awakening. It is. It certainly can be, and true awakening does occur at times through interpersonal contact. But the context of that contact, the context of that meeting, the understanding of what that meeting is really for, that is clear. You don't find this quite so readily at some social or religious gatherings where it may or may not even be clear for some folks what the real motives for attendance are. You might imagine that I'm biased against religion. What you discover in the possibility of awakening is that all bias goes away. There's no need for bias. There's no need for prejudice. And when there's no need for bias or prejudice, then there can be clear calling the spade the spade. There can be honest directness. The real cause of stress and conflict comes from the perception of separateness. and the perception and the belief that I am separate. And that which is happening to me as a separate being. This is the root of conflict and stress for human beings. Let me say it again. The perception of separateness, the perception that I am a separate being to whom things are happening, some of which I may choose or feel I choose, some of which I might realize I don't choose at all, some of which I actually would like to choose to not have, yet they happen anyways. The perception that I am a separate human being to whom things happen is the root of stress and conflict. Whether this sense of separateness is arising where this body contacts the so-called world around it. Notice that for a moment. Notice how there's a sense of the body sitting in the chair or on the floor. Notice how there's a sense, there could be a sense, that there's a perception of not just difference, but a perception of separation between this body and what this body actually right now is touching. Like the cushion or the chair or the back of the chair or the foot on the floor. And as close as that is, right now, to being understood, to being seen clearly, notice also the possibility that wherever the body is touching a surface, there need not be the perception of separate or separation. There may be the perception of touching togetherness, or how about, I know it's a bit weird, your butt is intimate with the cushion or the chair. Perhaps the sense of separation arises. The sense doors meet the so-called world around you. By the way, have you noticed? The so-called world around you is only a world around you because of a perception of a world around you. Notice right now, if you'd like, the sense of hearing some words being spoken. Space between the words. Some sounds of a building doing its building-ish thing. Is the hearing experience separate from that which is being heard? Or is it unified? The answer to that is it could go either way, depending on what perception or belief is there that comes right into that contact of the ears with sound. Let's try the eyes. If the eyes are open, not that they need be, and they're seeing something. Is the organ of sight, the eye door, separate from that which it sees? Or is it intimate, unified, one with? No matter how close or far that thing that's being seen may be from the so-called eye organ. If the sense of separation is the real root of stress and conflict, wouldn't it be interesting to discover, if it hasn't already been seen, that right beside, so close, so intimate, inseparable from, it seems, the sense of separation is the sense of unicity. The sense of touching, the sense of closeness. Or the sense of oneness. Is the body one with the cushion? Or is the cushion one thing and the body's another? Language would say the cushion is one thing, the body's another. The direct experience of the body touching the cushion might say something different. It might say, I'm not sure what's my butt and what's the cushion or chair. I kind of lost it in there. It kind of blurred. I'm not so sure. I'm not sure I want to believe what my thoughts have been saying. I'm not so sure I want to believe what I've been feeling. I'm not so sure. And some human beings, when they feel I'm not so sure, quick as they can, they go right back to what they can find that they're sure of. Give me the familiar. At least I'm sure of it. And some human beings, it happens for different reasons. They just kind of hang in the not so sure spot. They're not too upset and distressed or irritated by not knowing or confusion even. They relax even. They get curious, they get interested. As the dancer and artist of therapy, Emily Conrad Daoud, once said, I had been dancing for so many years professionally, in settings here and there, it was my career, and suddenly, unexpectedly, shockingly, wonderfully, beautifully, lovingly, I fell in the crack between the worlds that I had known. Have you noticed there's a perception of a me that's inside? There's an inside place, like if you close your eyes, you can have the perception that you're going inside. I'm going to ask you, where is inside? Like, feeling inside the skin means I'm inside. So then that means this is outside, right? We take these things for granted. We talk about them as if they're real. We assume them, we believe them, we agree upon them. There's an inside and there's an outside. And we go further than that. I'm inside here. I'm not outside there. You might be outside there. Things are outside there, but I'm inside here. There's a me inside here, okay, inside this skin casing. Okay, we could stop right there and just go, okay, can you show me the me that's inside the skin casing? Where's the me that's inside the skin casing? Where's the outside world that's separate, perhaps, from the me that's inside the skin casing? Well, there's a pole over there. There's a fan up there. There's a moon up there if the sky's clear enough. We got it all mapped out to a certain extent, don't we? Got names for it. And then we come upon that interesting name or word mystery. That which we can't explain, that which we can't get our thought around, we can't understand it. Like the question, where is the me that's inside the skin casing? Nobody can locate him or her. Can't put a finger on him or her. Can't say where I am. But I can say this is a body sitting here, and everybody would probably tend to agree. It goes further than that. There may be certain emotions that are not in accord with certain thoughts. Thoughts that aren't in accord with body sensations. Things that other people do, say, or don't do, or don't say, that are not in accord with how we feel, think, or believe things should be. And all this amounts, in some degree, to potential, keyword, potential conflict, born from the sense of not only difference, but the sense that sometimes these differences make a difference. They make a difference to the point where there's a sense of separation. And as tolerant as we may be at times, as accepting as we may be, as curious as we may be about the sense of separation, it gnaws at a human being. It ails that human being. And that human being wants a way out of it. Have you ever noticed that with this experience of emotion, right? Sometimes emotion arises, could be any kind of emotion. And the mind, the conditioned mind, quickly begins to have a story about the emotion, have thoughts about the emotion, have association to the emotion, have places, people, and things that associate to this emotion. One can find oneself getting quite involved in the story about the emotion and start getting into working with the story. I want to understand, sort out, make sense of, talk about the story so I can resolve the emotion, so I can feel okay. Have you noticed that? Have you also noticed the possibility at times that there need not be any story at all that comes up about even the most intense and unfamiliar emotion? There can just be the direct, pure experience of the emotion. I want to digress just a little bit here and share with you something from a very, I think, important book. And I'm not selling it, I'm just pointing to its importance. I think this is a book that my feeling over the last few days is that I hope every human being could at some point read this book. This is a book written by a young boy who experienced being taken in as a child soldier in Sierra Leone, Africa. Some of you may know this book. It's called A Long Way Gone. And I'd like to read just a small section of this book. My point here will be clear, I hope. This is called A Long Way Gone, Memories of a Boy Soldier. Just a preface. He's, throughout this book, alone at times and with companions, boys his age, roughly, and they are walking through this country that is absolutely torn apart with civil war. I've never read anything like it, personally. It's been a little hard to not read it. It's been a little distractive, in a good sense, I think. So this piece I'm going to read comes in after there has been much experience walking, wandering, lost in this country. Seeing unimaginable evil in the form of killing, death, torture. It's right out there, clear as a bell, that this stuff happens on the face of this earth. And watch this experience that he's having. One morning, immediately after we, that's he and his companions of about six or seven boys, aged 12 or 13 years old, had passed a deserted village, we started hearing something like the roar of big engines, the rolling of metal drums on a tar road, a thunder exploding, roll after roll. All these sounds reached our ears simultaneously. We hurriedly deviated from the path, running into the bushes and lying on the ground. We searched one another's face for an explanation of this strange sound. Even Kien, who sometimes had answers, couldn't tell us what we were hearing. We all looked at him and his face contorted with confusion. We have to find out what it is, or we can't continue on to Leili. This is the place that they were trying to go at that point. And so they began to crawl towards the sound. We quietly dragged our bodies on rotten leaves, and as we got closer, the sound intensified and the heavy breeze shook the trees above us. We could clearly see the blue sky, but nothing else. Kien hesitantly sat on his heels and surveyed the area. "It is just water, lots of it, and sand, lots of it." Kien was still looking. "What is making the noise then?" Elijah said. "All I am looking at is water and sand," Kia replied, and then waved us to come closer and take a look. We sat on our heels for a while, looking in different directions, trying to locate what was making the sound. Without saying anything to us, Kia crawled out of the bushes and started walking on the sand towards the water. It was the Atlantic Ocean. The sounds we had heard were those of the waves hitting the shore. I had seen parts of the ocean, but had never stood at the shore of one this vast. It spread out beyond the vision of my eyes. The sky was at its bluest and seemed to curve down and join with the ocean in the distance. My eyes widened, a smile forming on my face. Even in the middle of the madness, there remained this true and natural beauty, and it took my mind away from my current situation as I marveled at this sight. This is just a segment of this experience. And the point I want to make is there's a pure experience of contact with something unfamiliar, and then there's just an opening to it. A little bit of story, like, what is this? A little bit of conversation, and then this just opening. What if everything you felt, familiar or unfamiliar, was simply that, received as that, not needed to be turned into anything else? When I first read this, I was thinking, oh, they're coming up on some kind of warcraft, and all of a sudden it's the Atlantic Ocean. Did you go there? One logical question that can arise is, how come, or how can, the diversities of experience arise, and they are amazingly diverse, aren't they? How can these arise, revealing themselves quite spontaneously, and this not result in the perception of separation, and all that follows the separation in the form of conflict and stress? What I'm speaking about right now is the difference between the things makes enough difference so that it really makes a difference, which means there's a sense of separation. The perception of separation often translates into the feeling that something is not okay. And sooner or later, there arises the need to do something about this which is not okay. Meditation is one thing that human beings respond with, to the sense that something's not okay. Therapy's another. And of course, religious, philosophical, contemplative activities come right on there. And then from there, it tends to go downhill. Over-involvement in career, over-involvement in work, pursuit of relief through vacations, attachment to exercise, attachment to being social, pursuit for pleasure or relief through food, sex, drugs, alcohol, and escapism in any form. And sometimes that escapism openly, socially and culturally approved of and accepted. It gets so strange sometimes that the drug addict husband, and he's not drugged out on illegal drugs, he's drugged up on prescription drugs. Someone said, "These'll help." And he's going for it. He says to his wife, who doesn't need any drugs to sleep, "Here, try an Ambien. They work great." And she resists, understandably so. "Here, try an Ambien. They work great." I don't know about you, but if I couldn't sleep, which is a terrible, terrible agony to not be able to sleep, I might try an Ambien too. I might. Is your mind in any point hearing this through the filter of preference or the filter of judgment? Even comparison is a form of judgment. We have an amazing variety of ways of going about responding to the sense that things don't feel quite right or okay, balanced, smooth. We're extremely attached to comfort. We miss it by a good distance sometimes. We miss that conflict arises as the difference between what is being experienced and what is wanted. The gap between what is being experienced and what is wanted. There's your conflict. And the feeling of lack or non-okayness is actually sustained by beliefs constructed around it about what's meaningful or what isn't meaningful, what has purpose and what doesn't, what constitutes loss or gain, and any beliefs and ideas about awakening and what freedom is or isn't. So in order to see through these constructed beliefs and views, it's necessary to see the deep and pervasive identification that exists with the conditioned mind. There's not just a conditioned mind unfolding itself here. There's a deep, pervasive identification with it. The conditioned mind is made up of everything you can name or describe. Everything that is an object of experience or perception. All of it. All the thoughts, the feelings, the images, the memories, the beliefs, the opinions, the views. All of that is habitual, cyclical, and repetitive. And of course, all the behaviors that come from that. In Buddhist language, it's called samsara. And they don't stop there. They say the world of samsara is the world where the human being perpetually wanders, looking for what? Home. Where is home? Where is my home? Who can tell me? Can anyone tell me? If you're drawn to this book that I read the passage from, you will see samsara powerfully, poignantly, evocatively. You'll see the force, so to speak, of good and evil. You'll see this samsara, and you may also see beyond it. There's a possibility to see beyond samsara in any moment. It would be foolish to contract that possibility of the realization of that which is beyond samsara to some activity like meditation. Was Rumi, the poet, so eloquent in his poetry because he'd seen through samsara? Or was it because he was having so much wine? Or was wine a metaphor? Was it all a metaphor? What is literal? What is metaphorical? We make it up. So the conditioned mind is made up of everything familiar. And just to make it even, hopefully, a little clearer, common manifestations, very common, cross-cultural manifestations of the conditioned mind. Number one, attachment to suffering. Through the identification with being someone who suffers. I suffer. I'm suffering. It's mine somehow. This is identification with suffering or attachment to suffering. Strange as it might sound, like who in their right mind would be attached to suffering? Doesn't make any sense. No, what I want is to be not attached to suffering. Well, you want to be not attached to suffering. Guess what? That's another form of suffering. See it. Number two, the habitual need to be doing something. How about that one? I have been playfully accused by some who I am imagining love me as being a person who needs to use a broom and sweep. Thus, I've been called a sweeper. He sees a leaf, if he sees a broom, the two must meet. It's the experience of non-separation for Paul. The broom must meet the leaf. The need to be doing something. Some people get it going so strong. It's time to sleep. They know it's time to sleep. They feel it all over themselves. Everybody's telling them it's time to sleep. They've been telling them it for a long time. And they've been hearing it. They've even been understanding to some extent the need for sleep. They're even looking forward to sleeping. But they need to be doing something. And it's not sleeping. So they keep going. How about the obsessive need to know what is happening and where we are? What happens, one of the things, again, I don't want to refer to this too much here, but what happens in this book is these boys are utterly lost. Utterly lost. They know where the earth is. They know where the sky is. They have no idea where they are. They're just wandering in a completely dangerous zone where they could be killed in an instant. And they know all this. And then the next thing you know, they're dancing and playing for some reason, and the book makes this clear often what those reasons are. And the next minute they're crying, they're wailing, they're sobbing. There's a difference between crying and wailing and sobbing. That's where there's three different words. And they have no idea actually what's going to happen next, whether they're going to be alive or dead. And they don't have any idea where they are. And they're fine. And then they're not fine. And then they're fine. And then they're not fine. So we can get obsessed about this need to know what's going on. God forbid I have a moment of confusion. Or lose a sense of direction. I mean, some people came to the retreat last time I was here. And the directions I've learned on the website for Franciscan Center need a little bit of touching up, which I hope to get on. Because I need to do something. No. And two people came, I recall, very clearly. They came, and they had followed the directions to the T, they felt. And they'd been wandering about Tampa. Not knowing, where they are. And now they're here. I'm found. I don't know about you, but I was fascinated with the lost and found in kindergarten. I loved to go over there and see what was in there. Who lost something? Didn't matter whether I was looking for anything or not, just the sense of what's lost and what could be found. A little more subtle, but not always so subtle. The need to create meaning. Here's the conditioned mind. What's going on here? Where am I? What do I need to be doing or not doing? And, even more importantly, what's meaningful? I must know. And if I don't know, I need to work on figuring it out. Can you see this cross-culturally? We don't have to just be sitting here in this hall in Tampa. The need to create meaning. And when we're obsessed with the need to create meaning, we're missing that the meaning is being created here and now through everything that's happening. The meaning is this, and then this, and then this, and then this. It's right here. You don't need to add it on. But if you must add it on, have at it. The meaning of life is. And sometimes it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I found the meaning of life. Last but not least on this list, common manifestations of the conditioned mind, fearful projections and resistances to freedom and unconditional awareness. Fearful projections and resistances to freedom and unconditional awareness. Again, illogical, yet very, very common. I remember meditating at times, in the sitting posture particularly, and everything conflicted would go away. Everything of physical, emotional, or mental nature that was conflicted would go away. There would be no conflict. It would be totally smooth. And then this fear would arise, and this grabbing hold of something solid, because I don't know what's happening to me. Feels like I'm dissolving. And so I'd have a quiet, nonverbal prayer for a painful sensation just to ground me. Come on, knee, come back. It was weird. It's interesting, too. We don't know what freedom and unconditional awareness is, perhaps, but we're going to generate fear of it anyways. We might say, on the other hand, we want it, but we're going to be afraid of it. Because what we want is something that we've projected. We want it to look the way we want it to look. But then as it starts to look the way it is, we go, no, that's not really what I was wanting. This is not really correct here. I didn't want it to feel like that. I wanted it to feel like that. I thought it was just going to be an extension of familiar happiness. Just a broadening in all directions. That's what I thought. It doesn't feel like that. I don't know what this is. We generate this fear of the unknown. Actually, what we're afraid of is the loss of the known. Right, where's the unknown? The only way we can even talk about the unknown is something that arises into the known. It just showed up. It was unknown before. You make that up, too. It was unknown before. Now it's known. Huh. What's the unknown? Each of these tendencies is a creation and recreation of fixed points of reference. Fixation on points of reference is the conditioned mind's tendency or habit, which maintains its very existence as a separate thing through everything else. Very important. Through everything else, it maintains its separate existence. by fixing on points of reference. Even as the opening, which can happen in an instant, you don't have to meditate for a long time, even for a weekend, the opening to being the observer of life happens, and then there's often identification with the observing or being the one who's observing. I'm observing. I can watch that. Because not being able to watch that and have that overwhelm me, have that overcome me, that really didn't feel very good. So I can observe that, and as I observe that, I've got a little space, I've got a little distance, I've got a little balance. Sometimes unbeknownst to us, as that experience of being the observer clarifies, and there is opening to that, there also can be a very subtle and strong identification with that observer. And that identification with that observer is connected to the attachment to existence, the attachment to being, or you could say the attachment to life. And yet we know death could happen at any second. Body could just stop. Heart could just stop. We know it's that close. The attachment to suffering, the need to do, the need to know, the need for meaning, and resistance to openness or emptiness are conscious and unconscious themes that play themselves out over and over as the very structure of the conditioned mind. And at times, we can fall into the trap of thinking and believing that the conditioned mind and all its patterns needs to be removed. It needs to be altered, it needs to be changed, it needs to be released, and that we're the ones who need to do it. Since nobody else seems to be able to do it for us, really do it for us, we need to do it for ourselves. As we actually see the conditioned mind churning away, it can be quite overwhelming. Just to see it, it's overwhelming enough to be caught in it, to be swirled on that wheel, to see it, to actually the shock of actually seeing it. When we're not careful, though, we begin to employ meditation, prayer, therapy, even contact with nature, the natural world, as an attempt to change how we think, how we feel, or how we act. Embedded in this activity is the belief or assumption that inner or outer reality must change. It must change in order for true fulfillment to occur. True fulfillment can't be in samsara. It can't be in perpetual, cyclical, habitual wandering of mind and feeling and emotion and behavior as organized and purposeful and meaningful as those behaviors sometimes look. It can't be there. Fulfillment can't be there. Going right along with this assumption or belief is the assumption or belief that something must be missing. Something must be missing. Or something must be wrong with me or with my experience. Something needs to be added or attained or removed for things to be all right and therefore okay. And I'm the one to get it to happen. Actually, what occurs as true wisdom and clarity emerge is that it's realized, not thought, not felt, but realized. And that realization percolates out into the thoughts and feelings, into the body, so to speak. It's realized that nothing need be changed. Nothing need be altered. Nothing need be removed. or changed in any way at all within the conditioned mind. And if this is understood for an instant is all it may take, that there's nothing to get or to change, this actually is what the seeker is seeking, unbeknownst to him or herself. And the seeker is the one who's trying to solve the problem, make the adjustment, find fulfillment, relax, however the seeker goes. The seeker, unbeknownst to him or herself, mysteriously, alchemically, gets what he or she actually wants, through the realization that there's nothing to get or to change. And this realization may appear gradually or suddenly. However, when it does, a huge chunk of what ails the human falls away. Not because anyone made it fall away. Not because you made it happen, not because you meditated enough, paid your dues, closed your trap, were silent long enough, not because you ate the right food and resisted the wrong food, not because you slept the right amount and not too much, not because you got your posture just right, not because you went to India 10 times or once. Why did it happen then? Why did the realization happen then, if it happens? And the answer is no answer. It's completely mystery. But I can say a few more things about it. You get a sense that these words are going nowhere. Okay, that's an important sense. These words are going nowhere. Whether you're speaking them or I'm speaking them, they're actually going nowhere, but you know what? They're actually coming from nowhere too. Okay? If you think they're coming from you, again, just go back to the basic question, the beginning of the talk. Show me the you that the words are coming from, and we'll just solve that problem right now. Nobody can do it. I think that says something. Somehow, again, this word alchemical feels right tonight. There's some kind of mysterious alchemical process, if you will. I don't know if that's even a process. The effect of wisdom and clarity, which is the Dharma itself, somehow it reveals, as the blocks or obscurations or obstructions, the conditioned nature of habitual cyclical living is encountered, is actually connected with. Somehow it's realized as these blocks are occurring, even as there's a sense of needing to remove the blocks, all of a sudden it becomes clear there's nothing to block. There's nothing to block. And in that instant, it's as if you're newborn. You're innocent, you're vulnerable, you're childlike, you're infant-like, you're fetus-like, and yet you're wise simultaneously. You're informed, you're intelligent, you're alive in the realization that there's nothing to block. And that doesn't mean you don't get out of the way of the car, okay? Let's not take this too far. Some people will counter with the need to debate. So if there's nothing to block, why not just walk out onto Perry Ave and just get run over? I prefer not to. I'm going to avoid that one, if possible. When we're trying to change the conditioned mind, what we're actually trying to avoid is suffering. When the Buddha said in the First Noble Truth, life is suffering, he didn't pull any punches. He just went straight at the facts. He was saying that suffering can't be avoided. He was saying that it's inevitable. He was saying that conditioned reality is unreliable, is ultimately unsatisfactory. He was saying that suffering is an existential truth. What he was not saying is that it's an ultimate truth. So when we're trying to change the conditioned mind, we are trying to avoid suffering. And identification with the conditioned mind is suffering. In the same way that identification with anything brings suffering. Anything limited. Now you might say, what about identification with the unlimited? What about identification with everything? Somebody says, well, I've realized that I don't have to worry about being nothing. I'm okay with that because I'm cool with that. But I'm not okay being everything. Like, I'm not okay with that bigness. Or I'm okay with the bigness, okay, I'm going to be that, but I'm not okay being nothing. Okay, I don't want to dissolve. I want to be everything and not nothing. Or reverse that. Either way, it's identification. Just see that. So, does this mean that we need to do away with identification? I'm making it sound, in a way, aren't I, like identification is the problem and we got to do away with him or her that identifies. I am this, I am that. This is mine. This is mine. Well, if I'm trying to do away with identification, then I'm right back into the conditioned habitual activity of trying to change or alter things, aren't I? Is life a continuous DNA of Mobius strips with just continued repetitive cyclical activity? Is that all that's going on here? Is samsara all there is? When you're trying to change things, when you're trying to alter things, even if you've got a real clear sense of what you want, and you found out when you do it like this, you can get what you want there. You can do it like that. You have some mastery. You're a good pool player or something like that. And you've had peak experiences, maybe. You know what those are? It's where your nervous system and your brain somehow comes together. You get a release of neurochemicals, and you have a peak experience in an activity like table tennis. Or swimming, or playing music. It's a blast of openness. Abe Maslow called it the oceanic feeling. It's very blissful, and it's extremely and very importantly, is that a word? Importantly, temporary. Comes and goes. You hang your hat on that, you just hang your hat on something that just disappeared. If you're not careful, then you try to recreate it. And you might even get good at recreating it, or getting some approximation of it. That's called addiction. What actually happens as wisdom and clarity emerge is that the capacity to be present with all that life produces, the full range of conditioned existence, that possibility opens up. And it's seen that you are all of it, as well as not it, simultaneously, including the tendency to identify and thus have a fixed point of reference. You are that as well, as that which sees that. Both and. This small, in one sense, and huge, in another sense, shift is from trying to change the conditioned mind to seeing the conditioned mind. Seeing the conditioned mind is what opens up the possibility through seeing it that you're not it. And in particular, seeing the conditioned mind in its preferential tendency, the liking and disliking motion of the mind, which if you peel it down to a sort of more gross level of how it can feel, the craving and aversive tendencies of the mind. Peel them back, thin them out, and it comes right down to liking and disliking. Tiny little bit of like, tiny little bit of dislike. There's the conditioned mind. And in that movement of conditioned pushing and pulling of life, is it not true? The perception then arises with varying degrees of frequency or intensity. Life is laborious. Life, and if I frame it a little bit more positively, so to speak, it's a labor of love. The marriage, the job, getting old, having the body not work right, losing function, noticing that the mind might not be so steady or clear. Am I developing memory problems? Or am I just stressed? Am I just tired? Do I need another retreat to get charged up? What about a diet change? Maybe it's time for vitamins or minerals. Or a good vacation. Or maybe I just need to stop and look and not do anything. What is happening here? Partly what happens in awakening is the cutting through of the fantasy. It's a fantasy. There's something wrong when there is suffering. And again, please, if I break my bone and I'm experiencing that suffering, I want to go to a doctor and get it fixed. Okay, that's a good, healthy, skillful response. But if I'm sitting on a meditation cushion, or I'm sitting on my chaise lounge at the beach, and some unsatisfactory experience arises, there's no broken bones, there's not even any mosquitoes. There's some unsatisfactory experience arising. It might be nice, it might be interesting to be open to the possibility that there's nothing wrong when suffering's arising like that. As the belief fantasy that there's something wrong when there's suffering is seen as it is, then it's revealed that there is also belief that there is someone to whom the suffering is happening. And as this belief is revealed in the light of awareness, key, then there is no need to escape suffering. And here's the key, even more importantly. When it is seen that there is no need to escape suffering, paradoxically, suffering falls away. So you end up getting what you wanted in the first place. The difference is the fabricated, desirous one who wanted the relief is also no longer around either. He, she just dissolved too. And then, of course, a question might arise, who's left? We'll hold that. Come back to it, maybe. The medicine that's bringing about this transformation is unconditional awareness, which seems to begin in the simple acknowledgement of things as they are. Just the acknowledgement, yes, this is true. Whatever it is, yes, this is happening. Then this acknowledgement moves, it flowers, it opens into acceptance. This acceptance then moves and opens into loving presence. Along with that comes feelings like appreciation and gratitude. The one who's been abused and the one who's done the abusing, the perpetrator and the perpetrated, when that whole process, that whole dynamic of samsara unpacks itself, opens itself up in the light of awareness to be seen, unconditionally seen, then appreciation, gratitude, and even wonder arise. It's one of the fascinating things for myself personally about sitting with Elie Wiesel, who's one of the most, I think, eloquent speakers on the planet right now, and has been for a while, about the Holocaust. And he can speak about it with such clarity, grace, and a sense of wonder, not just that it should never be forgotten, but the lessons that were learned, the experiences that happened there from the inside out. He reveals these with a sense of unconditional understanding, to myself at least. Feelings like appreciation and gratitude for the power of transformation of the unconditional awareness. This is grace. Grace is not only that which allows all this. All this to manifest. That's grace. But it's that which allows all of this to be seen. It's that light. Grace is both the manifestation and that which allows the manifestation. It's the waves on the ocean, and it's what's making those waves simultaneously. It's the clouds, it's the wind, it's all the elements, and it's what allows those things to manifest simultaneously. It's both conditioned existence. Grace is both conditioned existence, and it's that which simultaneously sees conditioned existence. That which sees conditioned existence is awareness. So awareness is grace. Now I must spend a moment or so with some words about awareness. These are words. That's all they are. Awareness is completely personal and impersonal, transpersonal simultaneously. It has no edge. It is what the body-mind is sitting in right now, not the other way around. The body-mind is sitting in awareness. Awareness is not sitting in the body-mind. Awareness is operating in and through the thoughts, the senses, the emotions, the body, and all that which appears out there. There is no out there without awareness. There is no perception of out there. There is no perception of separation without awareness. It is silently witnessing it all. It is incomprehensible to the mind and yet immediate, tangible, and without center or circumference. The word awareness is not awareness. It cannot be specifically located because it is that which everything is located within. And it's completely inseparable from anything that it is aware of. That's the key. It's completely inseparable from anything and everything that it's aware of. It is the most pervasive and obvious element of life, and all problems or issues are resolved in its light. It's like the sun that shines 24/7, 360. Ongoingly. It's just an image. Also, there is no one who is aware. There is no person who is aware. Awareness is aware of the personality. There's no person who is aware. You can't place your attention on awareness. That's confusion. You can't locate awareness. You can't grab it. You can't specify it. And these words that I'm throwing out here are all pointing at that truth. There is no one who is aware. Rather, awareness is what is observing the idea or the belief that there is someone who is aware. Can I say that again? Awareness is what observes the idea or the belief that there is someone who is aware. Someone who suffers, or someone who does anything. Awareness is that which sees that someone, if that sense of someone is there. Because sometimes there's actions without a sense of any someone being there. That's what the heart of the Bhagavad Gita is about. Actions without an actor. Doings without a doer. So what does this mean then? This awareness is completely non-dual. Means that you know exactly where you are, right here, and yet you are nowhere at the same time. Now the part of that, one side of the dual, if you will, the I am right here, right? That's easy, right? I'm right here. What about I am nowhere at the same time? It means you can't answer with any thoughts or words the question, who am I? You can't answer with thoughts or words, where do I begin or end? You can't answer with thoughts or words, where do I come from or where am I going? You can't get a hold of that. That is the fragrance of the realization that you are nowhere. You are nowhere. And yet you are right here simultaneously. Unconditional awareness isn't anything or anywhere. It has no frame of reference, and this is the key again. It exists through non-existing. It exists through non-existing. Okay? There's a sense of non-existence, yes? There's an existence of non-existence. Even just as a sort of a whisper, a faint whisper. Why is it so? Because awareness is not an object of knowing. One of the faculties of the mind is that it knows things. And it doesn't just stop there. It labels them. It identifies them. It describes them. It distinguishes them. It compares them. It judges them. It interprets them. That's its function. It's fine. It's what it does. If it learns to do that well, you make a living with that part of your life, maybe. Or you have fun with it. You're entertained by it. You share that with other people. You're a comedian, which I'm definitely not. You can see that. I'm a wannabe. If I get to come back in another lifetime, I want to be a musician or a comedian, or if I get my way, the non-dual experience of both. Just because it looks interesting. Looks like fun. It's probably just as miserable as anything else if you identified with it. And that would be crazy to assume you're coming back. Do you know that in Bali there are people who experience the experience of themselves when asked, where are you from? They say, right here. What do you do? And they point to their activity circle, right here. I do things right here. Have you ever been anyplace else? No. This is my world, right here. You can see it. They don't travel. They just stay in the same spot. And some of them have a sort of a Hindu flavor to their religious beliefs. And so they believe in reincarnation. And their belief is that the best possible reincarnation would be to be reborn exactly where they currently are. Hollywood's going to go after that one, I'm sure. They're going to grab that one. There's a movie there. So awareness is not an object that can be known. It is incomprehensible to your mind. This word awareness, as I said, is not awareness. If there's any part of your being that just goes quietly or not so quietly yes to any of this, that is awareness saying yes. In the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful, loving Zen master was kicked out of Vietnam for unwillingness to take sides, but yet to go towards the conflict, not sit on his monastery cushion, but to go towards the conflict, to start a social movement. I think it's quite interesting. He has a practice called the inner smile. It's not a smile that needs even reach the lips or show on the face in an overt way. It's the inner smile of recognition. It's the inner smile of knowing. Knowing awareness is not an object that can be known. Or, again, the words are tricky. Understanding, experiencing, sensing, awareness is not an object that can be known. Like, this is an object, this is an object, this is an object, the thought is an object, the feeling's an object, the sound's an object, the smell's an object, the taste's an object, the memory's an object, you're an object, your body's an object. Awareness is what sees all that. So being as awareness, relieves the need to fix things up and thus moves you beyond loss and gain. Loss and gain still come, relatively speaking. That's part of the world. Things come, things go. There's this movement beyond that. And at the same time, still experiencing it. Sometimes very acutely. The idea that awareness is going to remove unpleasant sensations and feelings is absolutely wrong. It doesn't remove those things. It shows their truth. It reveals them like a spotlight or a stadium light that goes Being as awareness allows everything to be present as it exactly is. And it's then impossible to construe that anything is missing, that anything need be altered or removed. Nothing to remove, therefore nothing to hang on to. This is what is called priceless. Priceless not because of the assessment of value, but priceless because nothing can increase or enhance true fulfillment. True fulfillment resides in being as awareness. Being awareness. So on this weekend, just this weekend, many things will happen. Ups and downs, pleasures and pains, rest and unrest. Everybody in this room will be experiencing that, relatively speaking. Nobody will have just pleasure, and nobody will have just pain. Although some people come to a small group meeting and they say, "You were not honest. Mm-hmm. You were not truthful, Paul. I am the person who had all pain in my knee. In my head. It's not sensation, Paul, it's pain." It's not unpleasant sensation, it is pain. And if you keep talking the way you are, I'm going to show you pain. If your head moves down just a little bit towards the end of the sitting, I'm going to assume you've lost it, and I'm going to ring that damn bell myself. And in the sitting. The presence of teachings of wisdom and compassion, let's not miss compassion, the presence of these teachings on this earth, right now, are constantly unconditionally, yeah, without condition, without preference, constantly, unconditionally revealing with unfailing accuracy and precision the true nourishment in medicine. And this true nourishment in medicine is being revealed continually in the very minutiae of conditioned existence. And when we are blinded, and I do mean blinded, spellbound by seeking something different, we fail to appreciate that what we are looking for is being revealed through the one who's looking. The religions, the spiritualities, the wisdom traditions, they all point to the secret. They all point to that which is indescribable. They all point to that which is incomprehensible. They all point in their own way to the unconditioned. And then they even point further on methodology, how this might be understood, how this might be known, how this might be realized. But the secret is only a secret when there's someone looking for that secret, looking to find the answer to that secret. There's only a secret then, when there is no one looking for the secret. When there's no looking for the secret, then the immediacy of this as it is the revelation. Being as awareness is prior to all effort and striving. You can't get it because you already are it. You can't lose it because it was never given or received. There's no one here to give it or receive it. It can't be approached and it can't be avoided. It's grace. That's what grace is. These words are not the truth. Just as honey is not sweetness. And yet, in some mysterious and magical alchemical way, words can reveal the truth just as honey tastes sweet. So these are words from a friend. He says, all there is this and that. Being. The one appearing as two. Nothing appearing as everything. The absolute appearing as the particular. Emptiness appearing as fullness. The uncaused appearing as the cause. Unicity appearing as separation. Object appearing as subject. The singular appearing as the plural. The impersonal appearing as the personal. The unknown appearing as the known. It is silence sounding, and stillness moving, and these words appearing as pointers to the wordless. And nothing is happening. It is silence sounding and stillness moving, and these words appearing as pointers to the wordless. Just sit together for a minute or so.